The music of Kirk Mason, Chris Foster, Linnea Jimson, and Meredith Brown. They are the Bard Owls in studio with us today on WKAR's Current State. Also, the American Dream. It's all about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and doing great things. And it spawned a self-help industry that generates over $10 billion a year. Author Jessica Lamb Shapiro literally grew up in the middle of that world. She joins us this morning to talk about her book, Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. What would it be like to follow the Missouri River from its source all the way to the Gulf of Mexico? Janet Moreland did just that. She's the keynote speaker at this weekend's Quiet Water Symposium at Michigan State University. She will join us in studio to talk about her history-making 3,800-mile trek in a kayak. And how cold is it? Well, that question is more than just a setup for a Johnny Carson punchline. For many, the winter of 2014 feels like one of the worst ever in mid-Michigan. WILX Chief Meteorologist Andy Provenzano will answer that question on the program today. It's Friday, so that means live music here in the Current State Studios. The Lansing-based folk group Bard Owls are here to help us usher in the weekend. They play tonight at Max Bar in East Lansing and will be in studio with me all hour long. For Mark Bayshore, I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association, and this is Current State for Friday, February 28th. This year, being a meteorologist makes you a target for every cabin-fevered Michigander who has had just about enough of the winter of 2014. WILX Chief Meteorologist Andy Provenzano is truly the weather authority in mid-Michigan. He's in his 15th year explaining the good, the bad, and the ugly of Michigan's unique climatology. Welcome to Current State, Andy.
Thank you. Good morning.
Many of our listeners think of the winter of 2014 as the coldest and snowiest in history. Is it?
It ranks right up there. Officially, snowfall-wise, but not the snowiest yet. As far as cold temperatures, we've had more days below zero than other winters back in the late 70s, but it would be right up there. And when you look at how long the snow's been on the ground, that's probably what gets people the most because we haven't seen the grass in a while. That's one of the snowiest winters where we've hit it hard and it's been here for such a long period of time.
And we didn't have a January thaw, did we?
There were a few days. We hit upper 30s, low 40s for a couple of days, but that was the point. After we got past that, everybody forgot that. We went 35 days in a row below freezing. A lot of those days weren't 28 and 29. They were 15, 13, 5. So we went over a month where we didn't get above the freezing mark, and now here we're working on another week where last Friday we did get to the 40s, and now we have been staying below freezing, well below freezing, and will for quite a while yet.
When was record-keeping started on the weather?
You know, in Lansing, it started way back in the 1860s. It actually was taken at the Capitol for a while and then got shifted a couple of different times, eventually ending up out at the airport. But the records go back. In fact, the record low this morning is 18 below, and that was in 1884 and in 1875. So that numbers go way on back. And some of those numbers are probably going to be hard to beat. I don't know how accurate the thermometers were back then.
So Spartans were crossing the tundra in below zero weathers back in the early days of Michigan State University.
They certainly were, and I'm sure there were no snow days.
So we hear a lot about the polar vortex. What is it, and why is it so pronounced this year?
Polar vortex is actually always up north. Doesn't matter what season we're in. It's obviously not as big when you get into the summer months because there's a 3 months of sunshine up in the North Pole during the summer months. But there's also 3 months of darkness during the winter, so it establishes a very cold core of air that is meandering around. Almost think of it as a blob kind of moving here and there. And from year to year, season to season, it's in different places. Last year, this cold core of air, or the polar vortex, was over Europe, and they had a tremendous winter. Heavy snows, even into parts of Rome and areas that normally don't see snow. We didn't hear much about that. Occasionally you'd hear about the snow parts, but they had that core of air over them all of last year. And I was watching this cold core of air through the summer. I was up in northeast Canada. Every once in a while we'd get a taste of it, but in the summertime that means having highs in the 60s or 70s, not only 10 degrees.
Is this
so that vortex of air? Cold air is very dense, hard to move. And once it establishes itself, it's everything. The storm track goes all around it. So we didn't even have storms coming through to chase it away. So it's been sitting across all of eastern Canada and down into, at times, making it down to the Gulf of Mexico, as it is this morning, and the cold air is down there as well.
Is this situation that we're facing in the United States the same around the world? Is it colder or warmer this part of the year?
You know, I always like to reference it, Scott, as like pushing on a waterbed, where one area is going down, the other area is going up. And there's a balancing act in Mother Nature, whether it's from season to season or year from year, it has to balance itself out. So, yes, there's going to be other parts of the Northern Hemisphere, while this cold air is sitting down on top of us, they're going to be warm. For example, Alaska, the West Coast, gorgeous winters for those folks. They did see some cooler weather in parts of the Pacific Northwest as of recently, but for most of winter, it was very mild, and that carried into parts on the other side of the globe. We all saw Sochi have problems with some warmer temperatures. They're naturally going to be warm. They don't get a whole lot of snow in the first place in that area, but they were in the 60s. So there's always an equilibrium going on.
How do you maintain winter conditions when it's in the 60s at the Olympics?
Well, I think the higher elevations of the mountains helped them a little bit. They put, you know, the snow machines. We had actually, I think there were snowmakers from Midland or one of the areas up in the Thumb brought all their snow machines, and they kept dumping snow in there.
So the word global warming makes most of us think that things will be getting warmer. Is global warming a reality? And if so, why is it so cold?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. well, I'm not a believer of global warming because I've been forecasting now in the state of Michigan on television for over 30 years. And then I had all my years in college and before that, and I've seen all these patterns before. These records back in the 1800s of minus 18 this morning. So it's happened before. And the same thing with high temperatures. There's always a constant climate change. Mother Nature's always trying to equalize things out. So you might go through a stretch of 30 years or 10 years where it's really mild and you don't see these kind of winters. But back in the 50s, we had some really nasty winters. But I think everybody remembers the blizzards of the late 60s. And then we had the huge winters of 78, 79, 80, where the snowfall totals were way up there. So it does happen, and there is a constant climate change. Obviously, at one time, this was part of the oceans, you know, many, many moons ago. So the whole problem I think we have with the global warming issue is it's become so political that we've taken the science out of it, and there's agendas. But, you know, I'm a firm believer that we have to be good stewards of this earth. I mean, we can't do the things, you know, that they probably did during the Industrial Revolution and all those times. But I think the atmosphere is pretty resilient at times. Do we want to push it? No, we got to watch what we do. Hopefully, we'd find other nations doing the same thing. They don't, but maybe in time they will.
There's a great picture floating around the internet showing the ice pack on the Great Lakes. What percentage of our Great Lakes are covered with ice, and will that impact the water levels in the coming year?
A great percentage. Lake Superior, they consider the lakes frozen over at 90% because it's just impossible to have from edge to edge all frozen up. So Lake Superior at one time was 94% and totally frozen over. It pretty much still is. There are a few open areas. Lake Michigan was pushing 80%, and then we had the really gusty winds last week, and that actually churned up the ice, pushed it around, and brought up some warmer water from below, and it totally disappeared in spots. And now in the last week, since we've been below freezing, it's all come back again. It's all reformed. Lake Huron's the same. It's about 90%. Lake Erie, they're all pretty much frozen over. And that's a good thing if you're trying to raise the levels of the lake. For the starters, you're not evaporating out so much water as you do with all these lake effect clouds and snows every winter. And then we're adding all the snowfall that's going on top of that ice will eventually melt in. And I think we'll see a pretty big rise in the Great Lakes in the upcoming spring. Plus, we've got so much inland water, whether it's snow or the water that's in the ground, and all of that eventually will come through the tributaries, the Grand River. All the major rivers will feed into the Great Lakes. And I wouldn't be surprised to see Lake Michigan go up a foot, maybe more.
So the next 10 days, what could we expect weather-wise in mid-Michigan?
Unfortunately, it hasn't changed a whole lot, and I don't see a big change. We've got some light snow coming in over the weekend, Saturday night, Sunday. We'll warm up a little bit ahead of that into the 20s, near 30 on Saturday. And then we're right back in the teens on Sunday. And next week, it's maybe not as bitter cold as it is here today, but temperatures mainly in the teens for highs through all of next week. And long range computers looking at a big storm a weekend away, so another 10 days out, could have more heavy snow for us. And I go out as far as about the 15th of March, I still find temperatures flirting with freezing or below. We just don't see a real good sign of bringing in steady warmth of any kind yet. I'm telling everybody, I think this may be the first March I remember after being here 30 years, that I don't think we'll find anybody swinging any golf clubs in the month of March.
We'll figure out a way. Are you still having fun doing the weather 3 decades later?
You know, it is. It's a daily challenge for me every day, trying to get it right and looking at different maps and, you know, having, you know, the hindsight and doing some of the wrong forecasting over 30 years when you see a weather pattern. It gets a little easier looking at things going, I remember that, or I know what's going to happen here. So it's a lot of fun with that challenge, and I really enjoy my 3 minutes on TV trying to let everybody know what's going on, maybe educating in a way and taking them along a ride. I don't like to preach the weather to anybody. I like to have them come with me, look at the maps. Let me point out what I think here is why that's going to happen. There's where we're at. And they can be in that same pattern going, yeah, I understand what he's talking about. And that's important to me.
Andy Provenzano's weather forecast can be seen on WILX-TV weeknights at 5, 6, and 11. Andy, thanks for joining us on Current State.
Thanks. Have a good day.
The Bar Dolls in studio all hour with us on Current State. For Mark Bayshore, I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. In 1941, author Holling C. Holling wrote Paddle to the Sea, a Caldecott Award-winning story about a Canadian boy who carves a wooden model of an Indian in a canoe and sets it free to float through the Great Lakes. Many of us who grew up reading that book imagined ourselves taking up the paddle and finding our own adventures along the waterways. Janet Moreland has lived the Paddle to the Sea experience. The Columbia, Missouri resident paddled the blue and white kayak named Blue Moon from the Missouri River's source 3,800 miles to the Gulf of Mexico. Janet is the keynote speaker at this year's Quiet Water Symposium as part of Michigan State University's ANR Week. Janet, welcome to Current State.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
When did you first take a paddle into your hands?
Oh, I first took a paddle to my hands probably when I was maybe 15 years old in Sacramento on the American River.
And what motivated that for you?
Well, my girlfriend and I just decided we wanted to do something different, so we hopped in a raft and paddled down the American River in February because no one else did such a thing.
So you have a penchant for doing things that have never been done before.
I suppose you could say that.
What was the motivation for the 3,800-mile trip for you?
It was an exciting adventure, and I was looking for an adventure to do. I do have some history of some extreme activities, and the thought of the Missouri River starting in Montana and then coming down right past my hometown was exciting, and then, of course, going to the Gulf of Mexico was just off the charts, so I had to check it out.
So extreme adventures. Tell us about some of the other ones.
Oh, I lived in Yosemite National Park for 5 years in my youth, and at a ski resort in just south of Lake Tahoe. And I used to do a lot of ski mountaineering, skiing over the Sierra Nevada mountains and camping at high elevations and skiing peaks, hiking up and skiing down in the springtime, stuff like that, and windsurfing out on the ocean and under the Golden Gate Bridge. Fun stuff.
So you're an adrenaline junkie?
That's it.
I know the feeling.
I think you pegged it.
So tell us how this whole adventure came about for you.
Well, I had joined the Missouri River Paddlers Facebook page, and Norm Miller administrates that. And I put up a little bio, which he likes people to do, and mentioned that I'd like to do the entire Missouri River someday. And he just thought that was great because he paddled up the river, of course, in 2004 for the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial. And he just thought that was a great idea and mentioned that I might be the first woman to do that solo. And, of course, that got my attention. And from that day on, it's consumed my mental days.
How do you prepare for a trip like that?
You just have to chunk it out and figure out, it's nice to have a good resource like Norm, a good coach, but you have to figure out what needs to be done, the sponsors and the letters and the contacts and all the little logistical details, and then you just take it one step at a time and check things off your list.
When you hear the term paddle down a river, it feels like you're tubing or floating. Is there much energy expended in that exercise?
Well, I didn't think there would be, but there is actually. You really have to have a lot of stamina because there's a lot of wind that factors in, and oftentimes you are paddling against the wind. And there's one-third of the journey is lakes and reservoirs, and there is no current. So if you don't paddle, you don't move forward. So there's a pretty good workout there. I lost 20 pounds pretty quick.
Wow.
Yeah.
A great weight loss program.
Perfect.
The Blue Moon. Tell me about that.
Blue Moon is an eddy line Shasta kayak that's a tandem, and I took a seat out. I like the open cockpit, and I had bought it from a paddler that had paddled down the year before, who lives in Australia. Obviously, he didn't want to take it home with him on the airplane, so he gave me a nice discount, and I bought the boat, and then he wanted me to sell it back to him, but I can't get rid of it now because of the sentimental value. It's been down the Missouri River twice, and another paddler as well took the Shasta down, so it has a good reputation of stability and comfort.
An epic journey like that has to have its ups and downs. Tell us about some of the highs and lows associated with your trip.
Well, I think the highs really involve the people that I met on the river. We call them river angels. Just great, generous, supportive hearts that want to help the expedition be successful. I met a lot of people on the trip. So those are my high points, I think, all the wonderful people I met. The low points are probably the electrical storms.
The weather.
Sure. The weather, uh-huh. Sitting in a tent on a beach, you know, by the river, and with lightning all around. Those weren't my favorite moments, but I survived, so I'm pretty happy.
There's several locks and dams along the way. Did you do a lot of portaging as part of the trip?
Did a lot of portaging. I personally portaged around 10 dams, but, I had help. I walked around a few of the small ones, but I usually found a ride around the big ones.
Okay, so it wasn't just throwing the kayak over your head and doing what we see in the pictures of all the scout manuals.
No, I had too much gear. I did have wheelies. I had wheels so I could wheel my kayak around, but I had so much gear that I don't think the tires could support everything in one trip, so I would have to do multiple trips if I did my own portage.
So you kept all the gear with you on the boat?
I kept all the gear when I portaged.
I mean, as you traveled, or did you have a traveling group that followed you?
No, I kept everything on my boat. Yeah, I pieced it, fit it all in there like a puzzle, and I had a lot of stuff, but I was comfortable and all my needs were met.
So we talk about traveling by air and making sure we're always carrying on so we don't have to check baggage. How did you decide what to take with you on the trip?
Well, I went up to Norm Miller's place in Montana before I left, and of course he's experienced, and he would take things and kind of toss them to the side. You don't need this.
And what, like what? What were some of the things that you thought you needed that you didn't?
Oh, you know, I can't remember because...
The extra two fleeces and that kind of
stuff. My mind is thinking I brought everything. So I may have gotten rid of some stuff, but I had everything I needed, so...
Where did you sleep?
I slept on the beaches, and occasionally people would pick me up and take me into their homes, but for the most part, it was just on a beach somewhere out in the wilderness. It was great.
Are there kayak groupies that follow you on something like this?
Oh, yes. I had a Facebook page, and I just decided early on I was going to share my journey, and every time I would make a post, I tried to put a photo up as well, and boy, my iPhone took some great photos, and people just gradually became more and more interested, and then it became my passion to share my trip with everyone. It was fun.
How often did you tweet and post during the trip?
I posted almost every day. Now, I'm not a big tweeter, and I wish I was, but I just can't get the Twitter thing going. But Facebook, definitely. Every day, except there were 2 weeks when I was in the Missouri River Breaks National Monument and Fort Peck Lake, and they were adjacent to each other, and I went 2 weeks without any internet service, so I was kind of lonely during that time.
But. So there's actually places in the world where there's no internet.
Yes. I tried my best. Sometimes I would climb to the top of a mountain just so I could make a phone call, but that didn't happen very often.
Were you ever lonely?
No. Mm-mm. I don't recall thinking, I'm so lonely right now. No. I enjoy my own company, I have to say. So I enjoyed the times that I was alone and could just... think about things on my own.
What will you be speaking about tomorrow at Michigan State?
Relationships. Like I say, the high points were the people I met, and I think we're onto something here in the paddling world, up in all around the country. So I'm going to try to show as many pictures as I can, but really, it's about the people, the relationships, the paddler family that we're building now.
Janet Moreland keynotes the Quiet Water Symposium Saturday at 2:45 p.m. at the MSU Pavilion. Learn more about her adventures on Twitter at mo.riv.expedition. She's on Facebook as Janet S. Moreland. Thanks for joining us on Current State.
Thank you very much.
Music of the Barred Owls on Current State. We'll visit with them later on in the program. I'm Scott Westerman, sitting in for Mark Bayshore. Back in 1977, my friend Mike Dyer gave me my first inspirational audio cassette. It was entitled 20 Minutes That Can Change Your Life. The sonorous voice of Earl Nightingale pontificated about the power of the mind and how a positive attitude was the key attribute of a successful life. That was the beginning of a three-decade love affair with self-help. Over time, I amassed a huge library of audio programs, books, posters, and accessories, all focused on making me a better person. Well, what's it like to have grown up in a family where self-help is truly a way of life? Jessica Lam Shapiro did just that, and she writes about it in her fascinating book, Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. Jessica joins us by phone this morning. Welcome to Current State, Jessica.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
What was the first self-help maxim you remember learning?
my dad used to say this to me every single morning from when I was so young. He would say, remember, today is the first day of the rest of your life.
That had to drive you crazy at some point, I bet.
Oh, it drove me crazy so quickly. I mean, it became funny after a while, and, you know, years and years went by, and I couldn't even tell if he was joking or teasing me or he really meant it.
So your father was the self-help guru. He was in the industry?
Yes, he was. He was a child psychologist who also wrote parenting books. So he had written about 40 books before I started looking into the self-help culture.
And it was a daddy-daughter love affair, so I guess you probably traveled with him some of the places where he went.
Yeah, he was almost like a traveling salesman part of the time because he also had a catalog that sold, affirmational calendars and cooperative games and sort of things related to self-help that were not self-help books. And we used to go around to fairs where there were psychologists and try to sell the products. And you know how it is when you're a kid, you think that everything your family does is normal. So it wasn't until I was in high school and college that I started to realize that everybody's father didn't take them around and sell aspirational games.
What was that turning point? Was there a watershed moment when you realized that your life was a little different?
Well, it actually happened maybe even earlier than that, because kids would come over to my house, and instead of regular toys, I would have handicap dolls because they were used for helping kids who had handicaps. And, I mean, such a nice thing, but also other kids just had regular toys. So kids would come over, and they would see our cooperative games, which are games where nobody wins unless everybody wins, which basically means that they're not fun and nobody wins. And I would try to make them play these games, and they would just be so bored, and they would be like, don't you have Monopoly? And unfortunately, you know, I didn't, so they were pretty disappointed.
So it was a lot like Michelle Obama said last week, the kids in your house wanted to get out and go visit the friends as quickly as they could because it was much more fun. Is that what you're saying?
And I did, too. I just wanted to go play video games, you know.
So what made you decide to write the book?
Well, it's funny because I was so immersed in self-help culture, it was pretty boring to me. I mean, I wasn't really interested in it. And then about 10 years ago, my dad mentioned that he was going to a conference that was led by the guy who wrote the Chicken Soup for the Soul books. And I asked him why, because he had written so many books, and none of them had been hugely successful. But, you know, some of them were published by major publishers, and he self-published a lot of the books, and he seemed like he really knew what he was doing. But he seemed to think that there was some secret that he could learn where he could have a bigger career, more like Dr. Phil or Mark Victor Hansen, who wrote the Chicken Soup for the Soul book. So he was going to this conference with the hopes that he could learn the secret, whatever it was. And I was just so surprised and kind of fascinated that he would want to do this, you know, given that he was smart, educated, he'd written so many books, I couldn't imagine what he would possibly learn. And I was also really fascinated that there was a workshop where people were learning to write self-help books. That just seemed so strange to me. And it made me think of the scope of the whole industry, you know, not just how many people read it, but how many people actually want to write it, that I just thought, I have to go and see this. It's going to be really weird. And so that's kind of how the whole book started.
I've always wondered what makes someone think they can become an expert on self-help. What do you think that is?
Nothing. I mean, basically, the amazing thing about self-help is it's you don't need a degree. There is no qualification process. So pretty much if you've had an experience, you are qualified to write about that experience, which in one sense is a great democratic thing. But on another hand, is a little bit nervous-making because, you know, you're giving advice to lots of people who might take it very, very seriously. And that advice, you know, depending on the person, could be more or less useful, more or less crazy.
You had a life-changing experience very early on in your life. Tell us that story.
Well, my mother died when I was right before my second birthday. And ironically, even though my father was a psychologist, we really didn't talk about it. I think it just speaks to how difficult it is to talk about death. And in this particular case, my mother had committed suicide. So that was, you know, another layer that made it really difficult to talk about. So that affected me very much, although I really wasn't aware of it until I started, you know, how much and in what ways until I started writing this book.
And, you know, many second-generation kids whose parents commit suicide have that same fear that there will be some switch that will flip in their lives and caused them to want to do the same thing. Did that happen to you?
It did. And, you know, I actually sort of believe that it might be true because I didn't know what you just said, that a lot of, you know, this happens to a lot of people. And that was one of the ways in which reading through a lot of self-help books really helped me while I was working on this book. I read a book called Motherless Daughters about women whose mothers had died, and they mentioned that 90% of women whose mothers killed themselves think that the same thing will happen to them. And as soon as I read that, it was really transformational because I just realized it was just a common fear, and that meant that it wasn't necessarily a premonition or something that really was going to happen. And I experienced a great deal of relief just from getting that information.
Is that part of the appeal of self-help, that we have this common fear about being worthy?
I think it's a common fear about being worthy, about being alone. I mean, one of the things that self-help offers us is a community, especially, you know, now we have the internet and there's a virtual community, and I think it offers much of the same thing. But before that, if you had a problem that you felt was particularly isolating, something like, you know, your mother committed suicide, it's very isolating because I grew up not knowing anybody else who had been in that situation. And so that made me feel like I was really alone in a sense. And so if you can discover a community of other people through a book, that can be a really profound experience.
So it was actually a self-help book that helped you start to come out from under that dark cloud.
It was. I'm loath to admit it, but it really was.
You know, self-help has its upsides and downsides, especially from a political perspective, because it's considered almost kind of a conservative ethic.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting thing because I think that self-help, in a way, people think of New Age and the sort of flakiness, and that's a little bit associated with liberals. But as I started to read self-help books, and especially older self-help books, the basic message is that you can do it. You can do it on your own, and you don't need anyone else. And in one sense, that's extremely empowering. It's a wonderful thing that you can, you on your own are capable of achieving anything, and that's something that we really, really hold dear in this culture. On the other hand, that's also a great responsibility for every individual. And if you find yourself in a situation where perhaps you're weakened, or for some reason you can't achieve anything, then there's sort of a expectation like that nobody's going to help you. Because if we're all capable of achieving things on our own and we don't need anybody else, then really there's no one to come to your rescue if you do happen to need other people.
You know, you've read and studied so much in this whole industry. If you were to distill the meaningful self-help maxims into a few paragraphs, what would they be?
Oh my gosh, that's a really difficult question. you know, self-help is so interesting because it runs such a huge gamut. I mean, there's self-help about weight loss, and there's inspirational self-help, and there's self-help about parenting and finding relationships and grieving. And so in a sense, you know, it's hard to kind of come up with just a few things that they all hold in common. But certainly one thing that I think it provides is that we're not alone. I mean, that's sort of the most basic concept of self-help, is that if you're, you know, wanting to lose weight, or you're wanting to get married, or you have some loss that you need to grieve, there is a community of other people through books and, you know, also in your community where you can get help. And just the fact that help exists is a really nice thing.
And the courage to be able to ask for help, that sounds to me like a very important fundamental of this whole adventure.
It is, and I think that self-help books to some extent interfere with that because, you know, there's a way in which when you get a self-help book, you're sort of reaching out, but you're reaching out in a very isolating way. I mean, you're basically still by yourself. Now you just have a book. And I think that in some cases, perhaps many cases, that takes the place of actually reaching out to another human being. And I think that ultimately reaching out to another person, being in a room with a person, is the best help that we can avail ourselves of. So, you know, it troubles me that, you know, in many cases people might reach to a book when they could actually make contact with another person, and that might be more helpful.
You know, Admiral Jim Stockdale is one of my personal heroes, the longest-serving prisoner, highest-ranking prisoner at the Hanoi Hilton, and his Stockdale paradox is something Jim Collins talks about in the book Good to Great. And that's, you know, basically suck it up and deal with the most unpleasant things of your current reality without losing faith that you will ultimately prevail. Does that make sense to you?
suck it up and deal is a little bit harsh. Is that exactly what he says?
Well, I mean, that's a distillation. He said deal with the most unpleasant current realities that you have. And that's what, you know, there was no, sense that he was ever going to get out of that prison. So he had to figure out how to exist and how to have the most meaningful life he could in that place as a leader of men from solitary confinement.
No, I do. I think that's a really nice sentiment. I do agree with that.
Very good. Excellent. Well, it's wonderful to have you on the show today, Jessica. It's a book that I really loved. Reading from cover to cover, and I devoured it the minute I knew that I was going to be on this show. If there is one or two messages that you would like the readers of that book to take away, what would it be? Did we lose her? We lost her. That happens on programs like these. Jessica Lamb Shapiro wrote The Promised Land, My Journey Through American Self-Help Culture, available in print and on your favorite digital literature application. And based upon what I've read from that book, I'm thinking that she says that there is hope, and there is hope in community. We have one another. We can figure out a way to make things okay. Her website is promisedlandbook.com. Jess, thanks for being with us on Current State. Pete Seeger's passing brought back a flood of memories for all of us who grew up watching Hootenanny on ABC in the 60s. Folk music is alive and well in mid-Michigan, and some of it is the best practitioners are with us in the studio right now. Please welcome the Barn Owls to Current State. I love having live music in the studio. The Barred Owls, ladies and gentlemen. And I wish this is one of those moments when I wish you could actually see what we're doing here on Current State. We have Kirk Mason on the bass. Chris Foster was on mandolin. And our two fiddlers are Linnea Jimson and Meredith Brown. Linnea and Meredith join us on the program in front of the microphones. Linnea, fantastic, amazing thing. How did you guys get together?
Well, it's a long history. Meredith and Emily and I, Emily unfortunately can't join us, but she is our lead singer guitar player. She's living in Chicago now, so she's commuting up today. But Emily and Meredith and I started playing together in a MSU theater production of The Grapes of Wrath, and we did a lot of old-time fiddling for that, very historical. And then we just kept playing together because it was so much fun. And we added members from there.
We found Chris, and eventually Kirk found us. So
that's the way it works, isn't it, guys? they kind of come together like that. Meredith, when you started playing the fiddle, was it for music like this, or were you more of a classical person?
No, both Linnea and I were actually raised classically, and Chris was raised classically as well, and Kirk, I'm not...
I don't know.
Yeah,
don't.
You... But, yeah, a lot of us come from a classical background. It wasn't until I came to college... I always have loved fiddle music, but it wasn't until I came to Michigan State that I found that network. We're, a couple of us are graduates of the Residential College of the Arts and Humanities, and there's a course in that program called Music from the Appalachian Region, basically, and that's when we learned how to fiddle, learned a lot of these old-time tunes, and there's a really strong community in the East Lansing-Lansing area.
Kirk, why don't you take up the bass?
Well, it's an interesting story. Actually, I'm playing a washtub bass. It's basically a stick in a washtub with a string on it, so, and a head. So I found that in my friend's basement, and my friend's father pulled it out of a dumpster in Wyoming in the 60s. That's the story. It sounds crazy, but he brought it to East Lansing, or to Lansing, and I found it in his basement, and I was actually talking with Emily one time, playing banjo with her, and she asked, "Do you know any bass players?" And I thought in my head, well, my friend has this bass in his basement, and that would be so cool if I learned how to play it, and then I could play with them. But I didn't tell them any of this until a long time later. I learned to play that bass. I took it from my friend's basement, and I learned to play it probably about 2 weeks before I ever played with them, just so that I could be in the band, because I thought it was cool.
So what was your original instrument?
Well, I think the first instrument I learned to play was piano, and then I learned a lot of others after that, banjo and drums.
Because there is some similarity in the way that the strings are tuned in bass and guitar, so you got the same force going up. So
yeah, I learned the washtub bass before I ever played any sort of guitar seriously.
So that was the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. As far as the guitar world goes.
Chris Foster, your favorite mandolin player of all time. Who was your inspiration?
Oh, hands down, Chris Thiele. Absolutely.
And why is that?
I would say he's easily one of the best in the world right now. He's a child prodigy, but his music was really what got me into the mandolin. So it was his third solo album, Not All Who Wander Are Lost, in eighth grade. I heard that and just kind of, you know, went wild with it. So my parents got me a cheap mandolin on eBay, I really liked it, and so.
Did you have lessons?
Yeah, for a little while. I took lessons at Elderly Instruments. That was fun. It was fun, and it was certainly helpful getting a lot of the chords down. That's where I learned how to do my first chords, and so, but, yeah.
So is that, is it easier to be self-taught as a mandolin, guitar, bass player than it is to learn the fiddle?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a period of about a year, at least, where beginning violin players have the right to sound like a dying bird. You know.
But at the same time, if I try and play mandolin, I'm like, wait, what chord is this? I don't get chords. Yeah. Just give me a solo.
They have all the fingerings for mandolin, you know, basically, because it's the same tuning, but the frets and the flat pick are a different mechanism to learn.
So, Linnea, you also play the banjo.
I'm just picking it up. It's something I've been wanting to do for a while, and I'm picking up banjo. I also was inspired in part by Meredith to start clogging too. So it's really just there are so many musical and dance traditions associated with old time music and with folk music. So being part of the Bard Owls has opened up all sorts of other musical and creative venues.
It's very hard to get bored.
It's very hard to get bored. And I think a lot of us have this problem where we just keep picking up instruments. So if you see us walk into a show, you know, we have a banjo and a guitar and all sorts of instruments on our backs. We're like pack mules.
Sound engineers, beware.
Yeah, it takes me 10 minutes to get everything in my car to get to the venue.
Yes.
Well, that's why I quit playing drums.
Because
you have to take so much stuff along with you. Meredith, how do you decide what to put in your repertoire?
Oh, wow. We all pick up tunes in different ways, and we kind of have a very collaborative way of running this band. Everyone brings different songs that they've learned from different people or camps that they go to or just listening in YouTube videos. So we bring something to the table, we play it, we jam on it for a while, and we eventually work out some sort of an arrangement. Some of our stuff is original, some of it are original medleys that we put together from traditional tunes, but we kind of like to try something different every show. So I think every show we have a goal of adding something new.
Linnea, how do you categorize the music of the Bardells?
Oh, that's the hardest question always. I say that we are rooted in old time, but as Meredith was saying, we take that and we expand on it. We have a lot of original compositions by Emily that have banjo, sound sort of folksy, but are not quite old time. We also do some French-Canadian folk tunes. We do some Celtic folk tunes. It's sort of a wide variety. So that is always the hardest question, is how do you describe us in two words or less? I don't know.
Well, having played as a musician, I know there are stigmas that go with every instrument. So, Chris Foster, tell us your favorite banjo, Joe.
Oh, I heard one recently from a friend who plays banjo, and that's... What do you call a beautiful woman on the arm of a banjo player?
What do you call a beautiful woman on the arm of a banjo player?
A tattoo.
Let the record show that Chris made that joke and not me, because I have a terrible reputation of telling horrific banjo jokes.
I will not take credit for such a genius.
Kirk seems to be the only guy with needlework there, so right? I don't see a beautiful girl on his arm.
Kirk, is that your next one?
Yes, definitely. That's my next one.
You are a banjo player, so.
So, yeah.
You guys seem to get along real well. I mean, is the group dynamic important with a band like this?
Rehearsals are as much hangouts as they are rehearsals, which can be a good thing because it brings a lot of positive energy and creativity to the group, but a bad thing when there really isn't a pressing goal and we end up just sitting around joking and laughing and sometimes work doesn't get done. But I think we've worked hard to find a good balance between the two.
Linnea, how do you handle conflict, the inevitable conflict when you have five different personalities?
Also a good question. Really, it's like a relationship. There just has to be communication. And we've sort of worked out a system for that. Whether it's just deciding on what shows to take, we send out an email and everyone comments on it. But if there's ever conflict, we bring it up as a group and we try and be very honest with each other.
It's like any family.
Yeah, it's like a family. Yeah, absolutely.
Where are you playing tonight?
We are playing at Max Bar, the illustrious Max Bar. It's a great lineup. There's Gifts Are Creatures, Devlin is Brandy is the headliner. We've played with them before. Great guys. Nathan Allen and D.L. Rossi. So we are opening at 10, and then there are four other great groups.
Yeah. Doors open at 9:30.
Kirk Mason, Chris Foster, Linnea Jimison, and Meredith Brown are the Bardowls, and they will take us out in a minute. As they set up, when Harold Ramis passed away this week, it was like losing a cherished family member. Ramis's career spanned stand-up, radio, television, and film. As a writer, producer, director, and actor, he co-wrote Animal House, wrote and directed such quotable classics as Caddyshack, National Lampoon's Vacation, Groundhog Day, and Analyze This. His most memorable film roles include Russell Ziske, Bill Murray's intellectual sidekick in Stripes, and Egon Spengler in the 1984 smash Ghostbusters. When Ramis left us, I realized how much he had shaped my appreciation of comedy and satire. He once said that his characters aren't losers. They are rebels who refuse to play by everyone else's rules. My favorite Ramis quote, "I never work just to work. It's some combination of laziness and self-respect." And I think many of us who work on Current State feel that some days. At the dawn of his career, Harold Ramis wrote and performed on the National Lampoon Radio Hour. Let's listen to one of his most famous Radio Hour bits from this week in 1973.
Hi, this is Harold Ramis. A lot of people don't realize it, but the engineers here at National Lampoon spend about 100 hours each week producing these radio shows for you. The technical quality is just superb. But are you really getting all that we're putting into this show? Why don't you do us a favor? Walk over to your radio right now. Come on, let's go. Do it. Go to your radio. All right, now turn up the volume as far as it'll go. All right? Is it all the way up there? If your radio is working properly, and if our signal is coming out all right, you should be hearing me very clearly right now. Now let's try something else. I want you to go as far from your radio as you possibly can get. That's it. Go as far away from your radio as you can. Are you all the way across the room now? Are you there? Help, please! People are smoking dope in here! They're smoking dope! Help, please! Dope! There's dope in here!
Rest in peace, Harold Ramis. That's Current State for today. Coming next up next week on the program, we'll learn more about Detroit's music scene before Motown with an in-depth look at Detroit jazz. We'll also update you on the opening of the Volunteers of America Clinic. That and more next week on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer, thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery. Also, Aaron Young for Twisting the Dials is the engineer, and Libby Lussenhop for production assistance. For Mark Bayshore, I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. To take us home, the Bard Owls.